Jobs. We are going to start there again because they are jobs. Also, a very quick hit of what is Jay Powell thinking? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the fourth day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. 745,000 is the number of the day on this Thursday. That, of course, is the number of new applications for state unemployment benefits filed last week. Astronomically high, as I think I've been saying every single Thursday for going on a year now. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to hit us with the jobs report for the month of February tomorrow. Another snapshot of how this economy is doing as a whole. Good in parts, not so good in others. One part of the labor market that is doing all right, actually, manufacturing. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going with where the jobs are.
The John Deere Engine and Tractor Museum in Waterloo, Iowa, celebrates the history of mechanized agriculture. But the museum's hosting an event this weekend that is very much about the present, a job fair. Randy Venske is labor relations manager at John Deere's Waterloo Works, where they make those big yellow and green tractors.
The jobs that we're currently focusing on are, you know, general assembly, some welding, and some machining jobs.
He says the company started its hiring push back in December, quickly had over 1,000 applicants, and were able to fill more than 200 jobs.
Since then, you know, the number of applications have really dropped off. In fact, we've received about 100, 110 applications in the past 2 weeks.
He says they're trying to hire about 300 more people by April. Problem is, there's only about 130,000 people in the county, and unemployment is currently under 4%. Across the U.S., manufacturing activity is up, increasing to a three-year high in February as consumer demand rebounded after the early stages of the pandemic.
Manufacturing has been growing not quite for a year, but for the last 9 months.
David Burson is chief economist at Nationwide Insurance.
Because it's been growing, has needed workers, and they're starting to run out of workers for whom manufacturing jobs are the appropriate position.
And Jed Kolko, chief economist at the job website Indeed.com, says there's a skills mismatch between those hiring and those seeking employment.
The sectors that have laid people off,
service, leisure, tourism,
and the sectors that have done a lot of hiring during the pandemic,
manufacturing, warehouse, construction,
do require somewhat different skills.
And he says those industries that initially laid people off this time last year are starting to hire people back. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A little bit lost in the news fire hose today was data on fourth quarter worker productivity. Widgets produced per hour worked is the very simple formula. Down 4.2% October through December, the biggest drop in 40 years. Not great, no, but
this is a little bit misleading in terms of understanding what's going on.
Ioana Marinescu is at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice.
Businesses that were not as productive normally, just by the nature of the activity, such as restaurants and so on, have started reopening. So that drags down the average productivity.
And today's number was not entirely unexpected.
What's happening there is what we call a regression to the mean.
Now, why are we telling you this? Azaman Ozildirim is at the conference board.
It is a basis for future living standards. If productivity rises sustainably, that means that down the line, wages are going to be increasing on a more steady, stable basis.
And so from the History Matters file, this bit of context, productivity growth was really sluggish after the Great Recession. Wage growth back then, also super sluggish as well. Speaking of super sluggish, Wall Street today, forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tough as it is for small businesses in this economy right now, and has been for the past year, and is anyway, even when things are humming right along, spare a thought, would you, for micro businesses, less than, say, 20 employees, and how they are dealing with some really macro problems? We're going to do that. Spare a thought for those micro businesses for the next month or so. Today with Monica Matthews, she owns Queen Care. That's a body care shop up in Seattle. She also runs an entrepreneurship mentoring program called Life Enrichment Group. And she has been able to save her business this past year, but just barely. Monica, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to me about your community. As you saw your business struggling these first number of months of the pandemic, I imagine it was critical for you to get out into the community and as much as you could virtually sort of look for support there.
Yes. It was very hard in the beginning months of the pandemic, and it still is. We're not out in the clear. We had to be open to change. There were lessons, hard lessons, that we had to learn fast. We didn't have the luxury of time on our side. And so with everyone being, you know, at home and working from home, we had to pivot to online. And that was a big learning curve. We weren't as tech savvy to really promote the website or to be on social media and those things. And those were things that we had to start doing. We had to figure it out and teach ourselves how to get ourselves out there virtually.
How's your stress level, though, as a woman running a micro business in an economy where the conversation is in trillions of dollars of economic relief?
My stress level is through the roof. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But I learned early that I have to put myself first. I have to have proper rest. I have to do the things that help keep me grounded so that I can make good business decisions.
Yeah. Do you feel seen in all of this?
Can you clarify that question?
Yeah, I will. Do you feel seen as a Black entrepreneur running a business grounded in the Black community in this moment, in this economy, after George Floyd and Black Lives Matter, when, as I said a minute ago, the aid that's being talked about is in the trillions of dollars going to big companies where, frankly, they might not see you?
Yeah, there are times where I don't feel seen. And then there are times where I feel seen. So on a whole, I feel like since the murder of George Floyd, there has been more spotlight, if you will, on Black businesses and more interest in the Black experience. And so from that standpoint, yes, I do feel seen. As far as the aid is concerned and the financial support, I would have to say no, not all the way. Even going through like the PPP process, which I still have not received for Queen Care, I feel like that whole entire process, I was totally not seen. And, you know, I'm not going to say it was because of race. I'm going to definitely say it was because of economics, because my application just sat and sat and sat at the bank while the bank was replenished funds three cycles, you know. And I have to say, I think it was definitely because I was a small business that my receipts weren't big enough. But just because of that did not mean that, you know, my application should not have been processed.
So as we look toward, fingers crossed, the end of this thing, what are your prospects for Queen Care and for the Life Enrichment Group? I mean, do you expect growth and you know, bigger things?
I expect growth. This is really legacy work. This is not about me. This is about we. This is about community development and really boosting those in our community that may not have had the opportunities prior. And the fact that we are developing youth and providing internships for them, people want their young people to thrive, and they are our next generation. I want to leave something that our children's children can build upon.
Monica Matthews, she owns and runs a body care company up in Seattle, Washington called Queen Care, also a community support group called Life Enrichment Group. Monica, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Every time I say on this program that there is basically no inflation in this economy, I get all kinds of tweets and emails saying, in essence, are you nuts? Have you seen food and energy prices? Which is why I also always say on this program that we are talking about core inflation, which takes out food and energy prices because they are notoriously volatile and can skew the measurements. But All of that said, the United Nations is out with its food price index for February. And for the ninth month in a row, food commodity prices were up. The index is at its highest level since 2014. Dairy, sugar, meats, everything is more expensive. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains why and how long this inflation is likely to last.
In the food industry, grains make the world go round.
Corn and soybeans go into just about everything in some form or another.
That's Ben Bienvenu, an agriculture economist at Stevens. The UN's cereal price index, the price of grain commodities, not your morning Fruit Loops, it's up more than 25% from a year ago. Bienvenu says a lot of that is because China's buying more corn to feed its growing pork industry. Pair this with unpredictable weather patterns across North and South America, locusts destroying crops in Africa, and, oh yeah, COVID.
Things like labor restrictions have reduced agricultural production.
Megan Konar researches food networks at the University of Illinois. She says sick workers, social distancing, and outfitting processing plants and workers with PPE have increased production costs. And the thing is, even when the pandemic is over, when all these precautions go away, food commodities will probably remain expensive because the increased demand and decreased supply mean food is being pulled out of storage and prices won't level out until we have more reserves, says Jason Lusk, an agricultural economist at Purdue.
We're not going to have a new corn or soybean crop tomorrow. We're going to have to wait till the fall and see what happens to harvest then.
In the meantime, some of the extra cost will be passed on to consumers.
We're just going to spend more on food, frankly. And that will have an impact on families' budgets.
And that will impact the economic recovery. Because if people spend more at the grocery store, they're probably going to spend less somewhere else. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We've done some coverage of pent-up demand the past week or two. That thing where millions of people who haven't been able to get out and spend are thinking we might finally be able to, and soon. And when the way that people feel changes, as it is changing right now, that's got a ripple effect down the retail supply chain. Case in point, Urban Outfitters said this week that it saw a sudden jump in dress sales at the end of February. They call it go-out fashion, but making that quick pivot from selling mostly sweats and casual wear to dresses that you could go out in, that can be a little tricky, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
You know, it's starting to feel like there may actually be somewhere to wear a dress this spring or summer. Lauren Biedelsbacher, who teaches marketing at Babson College, just bought two of them.
I mean, I hope we're not all getting our hopes up, but I want to be optimistic. And maybe if I put it out into the world by buying these dresses and buying these, you know, non-athleisure clothes, then maybe it will actually come to fruition.
The problem is that retailers make their buying decisions way ahead of time.
About a season in advance, right? So 6 months in advance.
6 months ago was September. There were no vaccines approved, and we had no idea when they were coming. And yet, retailers had to decide what you'd want to wear this spring, which means they might not have a lot of dresses to sell you right now. Depending on their contracts with suppliers, retailers could possibly place new orders and get more dresses in stores by summer. But Brian Eshelman at Alex Partners says they might also be cautious because of last spring. When the pandemic hit, people stopped buying clothes and stores were left with a glut of floral dresses and pastel cardigans.
Retailers are probably thinking more in terms of not repeating that situation rather than taking risks and really chasing business right now.
They might be able to sell you some of last year's clothes, but Eshelman points out fashions do change, especially after a year like the one we've had. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm not fussed about the schoolwork. It's boring anyway.
I mean, we can all relate, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's. A tailspin on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials off 345 points, 1.1%, closed at 30,924. Blue chips were down 700 at one point today. And the NASDAQ plunged 274 points, about 2.1%, 12,723. The S&P 500 lost 51 points, 1 3/10%, 3,768. Urban Outfitters from Mariel's story fell 1.6%. Abercrombie & Fitch was up 0.7%. TJX, which owns TJ Maxx, Marshall's, Home Store, and a couple more, gave back 1.7%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Euler was talking earlier about jobs and the parts of this economy in which they are starting to come back. And they are, in some parts. But we're still down 10 million jobs from a year ago, and millions of people can't find work that they desperately need. Neil Cairns is one of those people. He has been part of our series about the American labor force. We call it the United States of Work. Neil used to be a bartender up in Portland, Oregon. Till the bar closed for good, along with his paycheck, it went away. And except for a couple of odd jobs here and there, he hasn't had any work since August.
I'm casting my net as wide as I can. You know, I'm applying at, you know, retail places and for physical labor and things like that. I applied for a driving job that actually I was offered, but when I looked up the location, turns out it's about a 45-minute drive. Oh, wow. And I don't own a car right now, so I can't actually get to that job. So that's what a lot of the jobs are turning out to be. A lot of places hiring, but
none that you can get to because you don't have a car. So that's the limiting factor for you, is you don't have transportation.
It's a big one, yeah.
You can't take a bus.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is kind of a new thing, too, because a lot of these jobs are outside of even our transit system.
How are you getting by? What money is coming in then?
So right now, I'm pretty much entirely living off of my disability pay from the military, and my partner's my wife's unemployment.
So this relief package that Congress is negotiating right now is probably going to be the last one, and you are probably going to be in line for something like a $1,400 check, and your wife will be the same. How far is that going to go for you?
Well, I mean, we've cut way back on everything, really. And so that'll probably go further now than it would have a few months ago when it was already desperately needed. But yeah, probably not more than a couple of months. Now they're talking about maybe the end of May having enough vaccinations for the whole country. I don't know how long that rollout will actually take. So maybe that long.
When we talked last time, last fall, early winter, I asked you, I don't even remember what I said, but you in essence said you felt you had been forgotten and overlooked. And just to break the fourth wall a little bit here, we've kept in touch with, you know, you and the producers on this program. And you sent us a text in January that said, I feel, and this is you now, I feel so astonishingly betrayed by the systems responsible for protecting and providing for our nation. Do you, as a guy on the lower rungs of the income ladder in this country, do you feel any hope that it's going to get better post-virus, or are you still...
You know, I really don't see a lot of silver lining. We are so eager to get back to normal that we're probably going to ignore a lot of the lessons learned from this pandemic. And so, you know, restaurants and bars are already trying to go back to business as usual. Customers, people in general, definitely want to just go right back to normal. And without some sort of structure, some sort of system in place to help, you know, facilitate people taking things easier, I don't see how this is going to get much better, you know, in the future.
But Neil, if a bar and restaurant opened up around the corner from you and said, hey, we can give you 25 hours a week.
Yeah.
Right now, would you do it?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I'd have a whole lot of choice.
Right.
And that's exactly the problem, I mean, is that we should. Providing for people in situations like mine, like those who are in worse positions than mine, to be able to stay home, to be able to choose when to go back to work, you know, in the way that is best for them, I think is really important. And I don't see any indication that we're going to make any attempt to do that.
Neil Cairns, up in Portland, Oregon. We've talked to him from time to time over the past year. One of the 10 million people in this economy, more, actually, if you think about the data, who are out of work. Neil, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks very much, Kai.
Talk to you soon. Saw something the other day while I was walking the dogs that I have not seen in a good long while in my neighborhood. Elementary school kids walking to school. That is school, not Zoom school. And come next Monday, most of the kids in England, that would be England proper, not the UK, which includes Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, but I digress. Most of the kids in England are going back to actual school as well. And just like here, there are a whole lot of frazzled working parents breathing a big sigh of relief. Marketplace's Stephen Beard's got that one.
Good morning, Mr. Thornhill. Good morning.
A distant memory, the pre-pandemic sound of a full class of elementary school children. For millions of British parents, like Catherine Bryan, this is the bliss that beckons on Monday when all their kids go back to school.
Oh, I'm so happy. I'm happy for me, but also for the children, because, you know, they get to go and see their friends, they get the interaction that they need, and hopefully I get the interaction that I need with adults.
In her small apartment, single parent Catherine has been looking after her two kids, aged 7 and 10, while also working from home full time as a sales manager.
It isn't so easy when you're trying to answer your work phone and the emails that are going off the other side. So I kind of have to work it so that if I take a phone call, thankfully I go and hide in my bedroom to take the phone call.
And when the kids are climbing up the walls, Zoom meetings call for special parental measures.
I've had to bribe them with sweets, with movies, with popcorn, just anything to give Mum 45 minutes.
Focusing on paperwork, meanwhile, has required a technological solution.
I usually sit with noise-cancelling headphones on, if I'm honest.
Catherine's relief at the return to school is shared by Roger Mortimer and his wife. They have two sons, aged 6 and 9.
Educating children at home with two pretty work-shy boys isn't always the easiest thing.
Roger, who runs a small marketing firm, has been working from home with his wife, who's in publishing. Homeschooling, he admits, has been a struggle.
Trying to deal with, I don't know, like sibling rivalries, getting into fights with each other and disconnection from friends, getting their work done, getting their work uploaded, getting them on their Zoom calls with their schools and so on. Obviously, that's been a challenge.
Parents and their kids have been under huge pressure, says Laura McInerney, who runs an online parent and teacher opinion survey.
We found that about 40% of parents said that their child had cried with frustration at home learning, but also 22% of families had the child and the adults crying.
No tears today in Catherine Bryan's household as 10-year-old Georgia does her daily online spelling test.
9. Another word for fight or an argument, scuffle. S-C-U-F-F-L-E.
How do you feel about going back to school?
I am very excited to see my friends again.
What about the school work? Have you missed being in the classroom and learning from your teacher?
I'm not fussed about the school work. It's boring anyway.
But her mum, Catherine, is understandably less relaxed about the disruption in Georgia's and Hugo's education.
Do you think they have fallen behind as a result of this?
Yeah, I'm petrified. I am, more so for my daughter, who's going across to secondary school. She's lost out on 2 years, potentially, academically, and I'm absolutely petrified.
The government is ploughing more than $1 billion a year for the next few years into a catch-up fund to repair the educational damage across the country. But Monday should raise the nation's morale. 7-year-old Hugo Bryan, for one, cannot wait.
All I want to do is leave the house, even if it's go to school.
The reopening of all schools is the first step in the easing of the lockdown, the beginning of the end of the COVID hibernation. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I would be remiss if I didn't share our latest peek inside the mind of Fed Chair Jay Powell. Mr. Powell did an online thing with the Wall Street Journal this afternoon in which he was asked what he makes of the jump in bond yields last week. Remember, we told you about this. There is some worry about inflation as the economy kicks back into gear, one hopes. So bond yields, the interest rates they pay, took a jump last week. Anyway, here is what Mr. Powell had to say about that.
You know, it was something that was notable and caught my attention.
That sound you might have heard had you been listening as Powell said that was Wall Street having a mild freak out which is why the Fed chair then immediately came back with this.
It's not appropriate to isolate one particular interest rate or price.
Tune in next week for another installment of our favorite game show, What is Jay Powell Thinking? All right, we're a little squeezed today, so you're going to have to find your own moment of economic context. Sorry about that. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.